Hello, this is Tamiko Faison, your host for Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to supporting therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color around the world. Today, our guest is Bill Wong. Bill is an occupational therapist from California. His primary setting is in skilled nursing facilities. He also teaches as a faculty member at Stanford University. His favorite occupations are traveling, playing golf, and organizing TED events. Right now, Bill is preparing his record-extending third TED speech, which is a record amongst occupational therapy students and practitioners. Woohoo! Bill has served in the Representative Assembly and Volunteer Leadership Development Committee in the last
5 years.
But welcome, Bill. Thank you for agreeing to join the podcast today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about yourself. That bio was very brief and very, you know, very humble. I know you do a lot based on what I've seen just in your Facebook posts. But tell us about yourself and how you became interested in occupational therapy.
Well, I had very humble beginnings, actually. So I would say check myself back to 2007, sorry. And I was finishing up my degree in statistics. So at that time, I was not very interested in going to grad school. And I was not really, I was like, you know what? My goal at the time was I just want to find any kind of job to start making a living. But little did I know, I was unemployed for a year and a half. So towards the 12-month mark or so of my unemployment, that was my parents give me a pep talk and say, hey, Bill, you know, it's like, you can't be like this. No, you can't be like a couch potato sitting here waiting to do something in life. You gotta do something, you know. It's like, it's either you get a job at work or you gotta start exploring other fields for studying, you know, for your grad school. I was like, at that time, I was like, well, since I was between a rock and a hard place. So therefore, I was like, hey, you know what? Let's try something out. So at first I tried business school because like at that time I was studying stats. And so for business school's concern, I had the least amount of prerequisites to make up for graduate school for business. But then when I took the graduate school exam for business school, I realized that my prospects in terms of going to a quality graduate school was not very good. So therefore I was like, okay, you know what? That's out the window. And then next up, we tried to go explore seminary because at that time we knew a few preacher's kids or AKA children of clergy. At that time, those preacher's kids were around my age, you know? So a good bit of them were either studying seminary or they just finished studying seminary and they just start being a clergy, a very new clergy at the time. But then we look at the job prospects and we realize that, you know what, based on the return on investment, my family and I, we didn't feel that we get a good return on investment. So OT turned out to be a third choice. So at that time, my mom actually worked in a school district. So she is like the school community coordinator job in a nearby elementary school where I live. And for those of you who don't know what a school community coordinator is, it's essentially it's almost like a school administrator working in front desk. So they sort of the people that check people in. Like I remember at the time when I did my school-based field work, sometimes they were the office ladies or the office men sometimes because like, hey, you know what? There could be men working in these kind of jobs too, you know? So the office people, I'll do some small talk to as I sign myself in before I work with the kids in my field work. So I definitely have seen that before. So it's like the front office staff, so to speak. And through some of her conversations with a school-based occupational therapist, that's how she found out a little bit about OT, and she tried to relate whatever she could from that school-based occupational therapist to me. And then I guess when we found out, it's like, hey, this is a good, decent paying job. The unemployment rate is low if I succeed. So that was how I sort of like my, and then yeah, that was sort of like how my parents, the first step in terms of convincing me to get into occupational therapy school. And then when I went, when we want to find out a little bit more, I remember my mom and I, we actually went to the prospective student orientation at University of Southern California. I purposely spelled out that because I am aware that there are three different USCs in the world, by the way. So that's why I want to spell out University of Southern California in that sense. So yeah, so we actually went to the prospective student orientation about the University of Southern California's OT program. And because like neither my parents or I have very far, very wide driving radius, so we tried to get to the health science campus of University of Southern California by bus. But we really couldn't really find a venue, so we end up arriving at the orientation late. And we actually missed the first hour of the 2-hour orientation. So the part that my parents and I heard was about like why OT needs more research. And at that time, because like, hey, and my parents didn't know too much about OT and neither did I. So I was like, hey, maybe research is your niche in OT. And to say, hey, you know what? Go for it, you know? And in retrospect, I guess it's like, it was a coincidence that I came in late, like my parents and I, we came in late for an hour, because I think I was told later that if I were told about what OT was holistically was all about at that time, I think I would not have been as gung-ho or interested, because I think that they were said about the OT practitioners working on ADLs, or about the arts and crafts movement of OT. I think if I heard the arts and crafts movement about OT, of OT at the time, I would be like, get me out of here. I wouldn't have been as interested. So I guess in a sense of fate, it sort of worked out that how I became an OT in that sense. I guess it's one of those ignorance, it sort of worked to my advantage.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I definitely believe in fate. I mean, considering that it was your third choice, and now you have rose to leadership and into multiple leadership roles in the profession. Can you talk about that evolution? So you fell in love with OT because of this emphasis on research that you heard about in your orientation. You graduate. How do you transition from being a OT practitioner to being, and I know OT practitioners can be leaders too, so I do want to say that OT practitioners can be everyday leaders, but you also have formal leadership roles, including, am I saying this right, Bill, TED, is it, should it be TEDx, or should I just call it TED Talk?
It's TEDx, yeah, TEDx events, but definitely that is different than OT leadership role, so I guess a little bit different. So I know in the context of this conversation for now, we're talking about formal leadership role in AOTA, if I'm correct.
So AOT, I guess, in the profession, so it doesn't have to be AOTA.
Yeah, but my personal experience with leadership generally is around that. So I think that's going to be most of my context of this conversation. Okay. So I guess for me, it took me 6 months to actually let go OT. I mean, part of it was because, like, you know what? It and like transition from a field like statistics, which is like very black and white, to a field like OT, which is very dynamic. Definitely getting used to a field, it was a cultural change, you know, adapt to a different culture. It's almost like you immigrate to a different country in a sense. So I think it took me 6 months to like OT. And I think that how I'm in terms of how I was motivated to get involved, I think that I sort of reflect upon why I was unemployed in when I got my undergrad. I was like, you know what? I was very lazy. I was very lazy in my undergrad days. It was like, I didn't do the stuff that I do now, you know? So I told myself, I was like, if I get a second chance in career, I need to make the most out of it. So I think that's one internal motivation I had since the very beginning when I started this journey. I said, I need to have an extreme makeover of myself because that's a second chance that not many people get, you know? And then in terms of getting involved in leadership, I think for me is like my first year of OT school, that was probably gave me the swagger that I had. I said it because like there were a couple of times I ran for SODA positions, but I did not get it. And then I ran for an Assembly of Student Delegates Steering Committee position, and I also did not win either. So I was like, you know what? I sort of had a chip on my shoulder trying to prove myself that is like, hey, I'm talented, I'm capable, you know? So those early setbacks really set me up. And of course, I know later on, a few years later, I know back in the day when there was the Emerging Leaders Development Program around in AOTA. So I remember I applied for 3 times and I did not get selected any of those times. So that was another chip on my shoulder. I was like, how come people in OT don't really give me an opportunity to prove myself, you know? So I think that from a leadership standpoint, I definitely get a chip on my shoulder. In terms of other source of motivation, I would say I know, this actually happened in my second year of OT school. So to put it in context, I actually, in between first year and second year of OT school, I was diagnosed as an autistic individual. So I found that out like 3 days before I began my second year of OT school. And definitely I was just like, you know what? My mindset back then was, I think that it was not about like, you know what? I want to be as involved as I can in OT. My mindset all of a sudden shifted to like, you know what? I just want to survive OT school of all things, because like, hey, that's the most important thing at that time. But that said, it's like, I tried to go down swinging in terms of my experience because of the fact that it's like, I was a struggling student. I definitely want to give it my all to get through the program. So I tried to disclose to my professors, my classmates, but they couldn't really find anybody they know who are autistic in OT. And then in November of that year, in 2010, so I attended the AOTA Student Conclave. I know that conference, it changed its name a few times already. So I think nowadays it's called a Student Con. So I went to that Student Con or the Student Conclave in 2010. It was in Louisville, Kentucky. And it was when I met my opponent for the Assembly of Students Delegate Steering Committee election, Jacqueline Swartz. And by the way, she is also right now, she is the outgoing chair of the Volunteer Leadership Development Committee, for those of you who don't know. Anyway, so at that conference, I actually got to have some one-on-one time with her a couple times. You know, one was just before the conference started. We actually had lunch together, but then really didn't really disclose much about what I was going through. We were just catching up and getting to know one another. And then the day after the conference ended, when everybody was supposed to go home, unexpectedly, long story short, I had a one-on-one encounter with her again at the airport. So when we found out that we had some time to hang out, that was when I told her what I was really going through. And little did I know, I got a pep talk from Jacqueline. And I remember that pep talk lasted about an hour and a half. I did not remember every word of that pep talk, but I remember towards the end of the pep talk, she actually told me, like, hey, Bill, you know, like, I already have some respect for you because of the fact that you were in that election competing against me, you know, competing against me for the Assembly of Student Delegate Steering Committee position. And now that I hear what you've gone through since then, it's like, you know what? I have a lot more mutual respect for you. Well, what you're trying to do, trying to accomplish in this career. And this actually meant to me a lot. And I think when I went home, it sort of lit a fire in me and said, hey, you know what? I know that Jacqueline did not really have to say this to me, but the fact that she did, she was very gracious and very supportive for somebody who she barely knew. So, and of course, I also understand her position in AOTA at the time. Definitely is like, you know what? If she can have that kind of respect for me from someone with that kind of high stature at the time for a student, I was like, you know what? I am gonna not let her down, you know? And then over the years, I saw Jacqueline achieve so many awesome things in AOTA. I remember, like, after she was done in her term for the Assembly of Student Delegates Steering Committee, she was selected for the Emergent Leaders Development Program, and she was a member of the BLDC, now the BLDC chair, got the PhD. I was like, wow. I mean, over the years, I was like, wow, she has accomplished so many things. You know, I was like, you know what? I got to do something to continue to earn her respect for me, you know? So that's the reason why I sort of pushed myself to try to do the things that I do in leadership. But of course, at that time, back in 2010, I was still a student trying to make it. So I definitely was trying to give it my all at that time. And I think a turning point in my journey, I mean, there are a few turning points actually of my journey. So one of them was in summer of 2011, I actually got to know another autistic OT from the UK. So he was actually referred to me by a caregiver from the autistic community, because I made a vent on Facebook about, like, who in OT is autistic. And then that caregiver replies, like, hey, there's this autistic OT from the UK, you might want to connect. And 2 to 3 weeks later, we did connect. And I was telling him about my experience in OT school thus far in the US. And little did I know, he told me, it's like, hey, when I was in school, I had the similar kind of struggles that you did, you know? And that was very reassuring to me because, like, I was able to really feel that, hey, you know what? He struggled in a similar way that I did, that he made it on the other side. Why can't I, right? So, yeah, so that was one turning point. And I think, a year later, almost a year later, I met the late Terry Oliva de la O. And we had been connecting on social media for a year, but we didn't really meet up until that point. And at that point, I was close to finishing up my final level 2. So I was like, you know what? I was about ready to become an OT, occupational therapist. So I was like, hey, I need some mentorship. I need some guidance for my professional development. And Terry was gracious enough to offer her mentorship to me. And I know I'm trying to go around the way to answer your question. So I know during our 2 years of mentorship together, Terry really challenged me in a way that my other mentors have not challenged me since. I mean, Terry really cared about my professional development as an occupational therapy practitioner and a leader. But she also said, it's like, hey, Bill, you know, you have pretty good public presence and your presence is just growing, publicly speaking, you know. Why don't you become a public advocate for OT? And I remember during my doctoral year for my post-professional DD, she actually invited me to go to a public radio station to talk about OT. And that was actually her first lesson, quote unquote, to me about how to advocate for OT in the general public. So, yeah, so that was that, right? And then in 2014, Terry actually passed away due to a series of health problems. So I spent like 3 or 4 months to find a replacement mentor. And at that time, I also was on a very low point of being an OTR, because I also was struggling with employment, because my first job out of school only lasted 3 months, and I was in the midst of an unsuccessful private practice attempt. So definitely, it's almost like I got hit with a double whammy, so to speak.
Was so your practice, Bill?
Yeah, I tried, but it didn't work. So, yeah, but anyway, that's another story, you know? But since I'm going back in context of the story, right? So I'm going back in context. So I was like, you know what? Let me try to find some quality mentors to replace Terry. So I ended up finding 3 mentors. So they are former AOTA president, Robert Comblau, former AOTA Vice President, and former state president of mine, Sean Phipps, and then the creator of the Kawa Waddle, Michael Iwama.
Sorry, Bill. I love Michael. We worked together.
I know, right? That's why I said small world. So, right? Small world. Yeah, so I had 3 of them as my mentoring team now. So that's how my mentoring team is set up. I know, like, one, I found the 3 of them as my replacement mentors for Terry. Fortunately, the 3 of them had something in unison to say to me. It was like, Bill, we would like to continue to nurture you or to mentor you for your professional development, but we also are aware of what Terry had done for you. We also are aware of Terry's legacy in the OT world. So if you do anything that honors Terry, even if it may not seem like you are, that the things that you're doing seems to be in line with your OT leadership trajectory, it's like, hey, it's okay, because like, we know that how much Terry meant to you. So we're doing anything to honor her that also benefits OT. It's like, we are not gonna step in too much about this. So in a sense, it's like, I think since that point, that was how I sort of blossomed to the leader that I am today in OT. And speaking of honoring Terry, so I remember I was thinking about, like, so since the 3 of them have agreed to sort of mentor me for my professional development, so aside from working on my professional development goals, I've been sort of thinking about, like, what are some good ways to help honor Terry. So at first, I think many people in the OT world know that I got on the TEDx stage a couple times in 2015 and 2017, respectively, as a speaker. But then I was like, you know what? I need to do something more than that to honor her. So that was when an idea popped in my head. It's like, hey, you know what? Why don't I honor Terry by organizing a TEDx event? At that time, I wasn't thinking one and done, you know, like the Roseberry float did in 2017. I was thinking, like, let's make it a one and done project. That's it, you know. And before COVID, that was actually my mentality at that time, because I realized that that has really exhausted a lot of my personal resources in terms of time, in terms of my effort, in terms of even financial resources to actually make it happen. And then after that event in 2019, I was like, you know what? I was done. I was emotionally spent. I just cannot handle another in-person event anymore because it's just, there are just too many things that were too complicated for somebody with so executive functioning skills. And then when COVID happened, things changed. I say that because one of the things that I have learned, I would say that I'm not a big historian of OT, but I was definitely very acutely aware of OT history, of how OT tried to establish itself in the past. I was like, well, you know, when I found out that OT typically are more reactive than people think, you know? And sometimes it's like, sometimes the profession, it takes a back seat and sometimes throughout its history. I was like, I know everybody at the time was trying to get over COVID, trying to adjust to the new normal. But then when I saw TEDx events around the world, we're doing virtual events, it had really evolved during the first few months of COVID. I was like, hey, wait a second. Maybe I can do something to plant a flag for OT in this arena, you know? So that was when I sort of get myself started. So, but then it's like, at that time, because I was still scarred from my first event, I was like, you know what? I want to be cautious. I want to be strategic before I really jump back in the fray again. So that's when I did a lot of homework. I actually observed over 50 TEDx events across the world that were virtual. So I had done a lot of homework. I done my needs assessment. And then I also asked experienced organizers. I asked them, I was like, hey, you know, how much does this take to throw a virtual TEDx event? And they told me, Bill, you're a smart guy. You know, just like you ran for this experience once, but then it's like, you know, with virtual space, you can be as resourceful as you can. You can organize things with much smaller scale because there are some stuff that you don't have to deal with as when you had to do it in person. You know, there are some stuff you just don't have to deal with. I was like, really? And then I sort of did my needs assessment. I was like, I can do a lot of the things that for a virtual TEDx event, I realize I can do a lot of things because one is like, hey, you know, as an educator, I already have access to a ProZoom account. And there were times that other TEDx teams, they were struggling for that. So I was like, hey, I have this resource already, you know, it's like, I don't have to pay extra to get something new, you know, and I realized like, hey, I am a little tech savvy. So I was like, hey, you know, maybe if I learn, watch a few YouTube videos, I might be able to do some basic video editing, right? And then I was like, you know, I was a speaker before. So I think if I coach other speakers, they will give me some credibility that I can be a good coach to them, especially from someone who has that experience being on stage. So definitely who understand the psychology behind being on that TEDx stage as a speaker. So therefore, they probably would give some credit to me in terms of like, not only in terms of preparation, but also understand a TEDx speech format to help my speakers to perform the best, right? So that was like, and then I was like, hey, you know what? If I can cut down all the middle person in a TEDx event that I would have done in person, is like, hey, maybe this is something that is achievable.
Yeah.
So that was when So that was how, like, now 2 years running, I've been organizing multiple TEDx events a year, whereas the rest of OT is still stuck in neutral. And I was like, well, I guess the lesson I want to share is like, hey, in terms of organizing TEDx events, it's like, hey, you know, just like business, you got to do your homework of your, not only in the sense, you're not competing against other TEDx events, but I was like, hey, you know, you got to do some homework to see what your compatriots are doing. You know, you want to see breakdowns pieces to see if what part of these things that you can implement, and then you can just implement it, you know? So I just like that, I guess like that's some cross similarity in terms of how I run my TEDx events to entrepreneurship, because like, even though these TEDx events are nonprofit by nature versus like, and most OT entrepreneur ventures are supposed to make profit, but that said, there are some similarities in that regard. But that said, I think that one of the things I also learned for this experience is like, hey, you know, it's like, I can definitely set a good example of how to proactively advocate for OT, while instead of waiting for others to invite us to sit at their tables, so to speak. So that's another lesson that I've learned.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, you answered a lot of the questions just with that response, and there are a lot of things that I just want to go over. So you talked about people speaking into your life. You talked about the power of mentors, and it sounds like you were really intentional and initiated those relationships. You spoke about connecting with someone who has a shared lived experience, and you put that out there on, I think you said on social media, and someone responded. And then you talked about, you know, how you had these periods where you were down, but you got back up and you tried again. And made some observations in terms of where the world was going with these TEDx talks. And I know you made the comment that OT sometimes can be reactive, which is why we need to highlight our innovators and our leaders in the profession who are proactive. I wonder, Bill, if you can speak on the diversity in the profession and how that has impacted you, and what advice you would give to someone who's underrepresented in our profession.
Wow, that's a loaded question. I'm good. I'm just saying that, you know, as part of playing with the words, so that I can give myself some time to think about the issue, you know? So yeah, it's sort of like, I just sort of buying some time to think about a response. But anyway, so yeah. So as somebody who is a minority on three fronts in OT, so as an Asian, as a man, as an individual with a disability, so definitely I see that in being a minority in this profession. I think that I know that for me, when I was studying in OT school, I was very fortunate to be with a diverse cohort. I would say this is just my observation in Southern California. In Southern California, at least for the schools that I either teach at or been a part of a student body, or I have been guest lectured for, like many of these classes were actually very diverse. But that said, you know, I think that because I was in that kind of quote-unquote sheltered environment, so when these folks, they actually attend a conference like AOTA, that was when they had a culture shock. It's like, oh my God, it's like, I didn't realize that the profession has a lot of Caucasian, a lot of women in the profession, you know? So it's like, it's almost like for me, as somebody who study in OT in Southern California programs, it's almost the other way around. It's like, how do people like that get over the culture shock of the reality of AOTA? So yeah, or even the OT profession in general, how do we get over the reality like that, you know? So I was thinking that having a minority role model, I think, is very important. So actually, I don't know if you caught that. So when I actually was very serious about featuring OT on the TEDx platform, one of the approaches, I was like, you know what, let me try to identify underrepresented voices, underrepresented perspectives in OT that the other tennis organizers who don't know as much about OT can capture. So that's the reason why I invited Dublin Jackson to be my TEDx speaker for my event last September. It's because, like, while I did some history, I did some digging in terms of occupational therapy students and practitioners who have done TEDx talk on stage as a speaker. I realized that, like, I was 90% confident. You know, these kind of racial kind of things, I don't want to be 100% certain. You know, I could be wrong in some instance, right? So I was like, based on my informal research, you know, like, I was 90% certain that there were no Black OT practitioners who have gotten on stage before on TEDx. So I was like, hey, why don't I do something like this to sort of raise awareness of OT among potential Black students that may want to enter the field, you know?
Thank you.
Yeah.
I did speak to Dublin, and it was Dr. Dublin Jackson. It was excellent. So I appreciate you recognizing the need to highlight voices of OT practitioners who are underrepresented in our profession. Thank you.
Yeah, and of course, it's like we're recognizing that, you know, this kind of voice are needed in the general public in OT. I was thinking, it's like, hey, you know, I can produce a long-lasting artifact that people can search up on YouTube for years to come, for decades to come, rather than like a rose parade float. It's like, hey, it's one and done, you know? It's like, once the float is over, the float is no longer there, you know? So at least I can contribute a piece of OT history and say, hey, you know what? This is what happened in 2019. No, not 2019, 2021, you know? It's late, but at least it's better late than never in that regard. At least it's like, hey, I use my privileges as a tax manager to make a difference for our profession, right?
I love it. So use your privilege to make a difference in the profession, and better late than never. Do you have another quote that you'd like to end on? I mean, your whole talk has been filled with lots of pearls of wisdom that I'm going to go back and listen to, because it's been inspirational for me just to think about how intentional you were and are about your leadership roles. What last pearl of wisdom or quote would you like to leave our audience with?
I think that if you want to be successful, whether you're in entrepreneurship or in leadership, I think it is important to own, if in terms of leadership, is own your leadership trajectory, you know, have ownership of it, and if you're doing business, definitely take ownership of your business for its up and downs, you know? So I think taking ownership is very important. I know for me, with my professional career, I definitely take a lot of ownership in terms of what I want to do for my career. And of course, there are times that I don't understand that what I might be in for. So that's when I pull my mentors aside and say, hey, you know what? I'm interested in this, but I am not sure whether this is right for me. But I also have a rule to my mentors and say, hey, you know what? Don't sell me about these opportunities that might interest me. Don't sell me about how awesome they are. I just want to know if they're the right fit. And give me objective facts, not a sales pitch. And my mentors, they understand that, like, okay, you know what? We'll do that for you. You know, it's like, it seems like you are a very analytical person. You probably can't come to your own decision. And for you, it's like, well, we probably need to give some facts so that you can see all the cards on the table, you know? So I think, yeah, right? So yeah, that's my wisdom. What?
It's like you're creating your own advisory board. In entrepreneurship, in my practice, we have advisory boards, and it sounds like you created your own advisory board to reflect objectively when you're making important decisions.
Oh yeah, for sure, right? Although in TEDx is like, well, I have to act as my own advisory board because like, hey, you know what? It's hard because like, okay, you know what? The advisory board is the guidelines I have to go by, you know? So I just sort of like, okay, you know, I had to think about like, does the speaker fit, you know? Or I was like, hey, where else can I fit if I cannot find room for that person for this particular event? Yeah, it's almost like, I guess for me it's like, maybe because of my personality. So I'm very used to being self-directed in terms of my professional development. So yeah, having an advisory board is so key. Or in some cases, like a sounding board is also good too, because like, you know what? They may not understand what you're doing, but sometimes it's like a sounding board can be very helpful as well.
Yeah, I love that. Advisory board and a sounding board. And so, Bill, how can we support you in your work? It's like, what's next for you and how can we support you in it?
Good question, actually. So, what's my work? I think for me right now, one of my weaker areas, there are actually a few. One is that hopefully I have more opportunities to publish. I think I know that's one of my big points of my CV. I mean, I'm nitpicking here because I realized that like, hey, you know, I realized that in spite of what I've done, I actually don't have as many publications as people think I would have, you know? So it's like, okay, you know what? Hopefully I can get more recommendations to actually contribute in either research or even like, I'm actually lately I've been interested in contributing to our textbooks in at least a section of the chapter, if not a chapter. I'm actually very interested in that because I believe that, hey, I pay my dues, I'm a scholar, I believe that I have things that are valuable to contribute to the next generation of OT practitioners. So I feel that I can contribute in that regard. And I think secondly, I think that hopefully in terms of after hearing my story, I think that maybe that will sort of inspire them to think about like, hey, Bill is actually traditionally a very busy guy, yet he made some room to still organize TEDx events to promote OT. You know, it's like maybe people can find me as a role model. And I don't want to like in terms of say, hey, can we help you in an event kind of deal? I'd rather say, hey, you know what? If Bill can do this, in spite of how busy he is, maybe I can replicate what he does. And in the TEDx world, I just don't mind copycatting because like, hey, if I inspire somebody to do the same thing, to promote more avenues for OTs to advocate on that kind of platform, I feel like I've done my job.
Wow, Bill. I think this is a great note to end on. It reminds me of, I don't know if you're familiar with this book, it's called The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And one of those habits is think win-win. And so instead of you talking about what we can do to help you with your TEDx talk, you said you want other people to look at you, be inspired, and consider doing their own. So you're not feeling like you want to be the person that has the monopoly over the space in OT. You want other people to go out, be inspired, and also do TEDx talks that help benefit the profession. So again, thank you, Bill. You've been a great guest. And like I said, I'm going to replay this and just listen again for inspiration. I hope our guests were inspired. And thank you, Bill. So don't forget to follow. And until next time.
Oh, hold on. Can we change the wording a little bit? Instead of do, is organized. Because a lot of times when people say do, people associate with speaking on the platform.
Okay, so organize the TEDx talk. Thank you. I will leave this in here. I won't even edit it out. I am okay with being corrected. It's one of the things that I have been working on myself, because sometimes I hear people say things and I don't necessarily correct or say anything back after I hear it. And so I've been doing that more lately, and people have been doing it to me also. So thank you for the correction, Bill. So organize TEDx talks. So you don't necessarily have to be the person standing up there and speaking, but you organize it and find the speakers. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's more accurate, you know. Yeah, because I was thinking, I was like, hey, you know, that can be more opportunities for OT practitioners to get on that platform, you know. Yeah, because it's like, you know, it's like sometimes I get like a few dozen requests, and I keep on telling people, I was like, even if I do once a month, it's like I will never meet the demand of what you guys want. I was like, please don't kill me here, you know?
I'm glad you said that too. So we'll end on this note. I think the same thing with many of the needs that we see in our society, that if there were 10 other competitors doing what I was doing, we still would not meet the needs in our society. So we welcome other people to move into these non-traditional, so to speak, spaces to continue to grow our profession in many ways that, you know, it has not historically been in. So thank you again, Bill. I hope everyone enjoyed our podcast today. Don't forget to follow. Until next time.
No problem. See ya.
Bye.